Today's Taisho will be on case 4 in the Concordant Sounds collection of verse commentaries. The Concordant, let me read it first and then I can explain. Case 4, Anguimala and the Difficult Delivery. After Anguimala had left the householder's life and become a monk, he went into the city with his begging bowl. He came to the home of a wealthy man whose wife was having a difficult delivery. The man said, "As a disciple of Gautama, you must be very wise. Is there not something you can do to spare my wife this difficult delivery?" Anguimala replied, "I have only recently entered the way and do not yet know of any way of doing this. I will go ask the Buddha and then return and tell you." And so he returned and explained the matter to the Buddha, who told him thus, "Go quickly and say to him, 'In all the time I have followed the saintly and sagely way, never once have I taken a life.'" Anguimala went back and told the wealthy man. As soon as his wife heard this, she gave birth. Both the mother and the child were fine. Chan Master Miao Zhong, this is her poem, "Neither slow by a single step, nor quick by a single minute, the clear-eyed, patch-robed monk. How does he know what to do? Shattered bones and crushed flesh won't cancel your debts. One word of insight is worth 10 million words of apology." Chan Master Bao Qi, "A tree overgrown with weeds, a jade carved to perfection, a lonely and desolate spot, the view of elegance and charm. The young lad seeking out the source of the night fragrance sees nothing but the moon shining at the foot of the stairs." Chan Master Zukui, "Smash and break open the fetters of gold, lift and flip over the platter of white jade. Others may be concerned over loss and gain, but nothing can touch one's peace of mind." So, thank you all for coming to practice this morning and for sitting so well. It's so wonderful to practice with people who sit so wholeheartedly. You know, we have been sitting, many of us have been here since 7 this morning or 8 this morning, and sitting, purifying body, mind, and heart. It's so wonderful to have this kind of practice of this depth and to practice with all of you. Thank you so much. So I haven't ever read a koan from this collection. It's the Concordant Sounds of Verse Commentaries. And basically, it's a collection of koans with commentaries by three women Zen masters. They were disciples of Dahui, 17th century Chan Rinzai Linji Chan Master. And Dahui was completely uninterested in making distinctions on the basis of a person's gender. So he had a number of deeply enlightened Dharma heirs who were women. And this was a time when a great many women were very active in Buddhism in China. These three nuns all had lived lives before they took monastic vows as householders. So they two of them had had families and had become interested in Buddhism later in their lives and really threw themselves into it and practiced with great diligence and studied under Da Hui. In those two cases, one person just did not have a family, but the two older women both had been wives and mothers, and in one case the husband died, and in another case basically the couple decided to go their separate ways later in life. And these women entered the monastic community, you know, shaved their heads, and became real leaders in the Linji Chan, Linji Zen world, and had many enlightened students themselves of both genders. So this is a really wonderful collection. It's entitled Zen Echoes, Classic Koans with Verse Commentaries by three female Zen masters. So I highly recommend it, and I've been reading it with great interest, and the responses of the three nuns are really wonderful. They're really deep insight. So this case four, I think, is really appropriate for where the world is right now. This, as I read it, I think it was pretty clear that a woman is having a difficult delivery, and she asks for a Buddhist monk to come. And there's this Buddhist monk named Anguillimala, who comes, and she, you know, basically she's in agony, and she says, "Is there anything you can do to help me?" And he says, "You know, I'm just a beginner myself. But let me go ask the Buddha." And he goes and asks the Buddha, and the Buddha says something that might seem perfectly clear and straightforward and simple. He says, "I have only recently entered the way and do not yet know how to do this." What he says, the Buddha says to him is, "Go quickly and say to him, 'In all the time I have followed the saintly and sagely way, never have I taken life.'" And he goes back and says that to the woman, and the difficult delivery ceases, and she's at peace, and all goes well. It's important to know that Anguillimala is a famous figure in Buddhist history. He began his life in very unpromising circumstances. He was poor, and he became a robber, right? He would lie in wait on the road, and when passengers came by, he would shake them down for their money. And he was a highwayman. That's the word I'm looking for. He was what used to be called a highwayman. And he would go up and down the roads and waylay people and take all their money. But he wouldn't just do that. He would kill them. So he was famous as a ruthless, cruel bandit. And he actually used to cut the fingers off of his victims and string them around his neck. See. So his name, Anguillimala, means string of a necklace of fingers, like a mala people wear around. You'll see Buddhist monks and nuns with mala, those strings of beads. This is string of beads of fingers, right? So this is somebody who you would imagine is like hopelessly terrible person. And according to traditional Buddhist ways of thinking, a person like this would be reborn in the hell realms for many lifetimes. Right? You know, in Buddhist thinking about the world, this idea of karma is very important in traditional Buddhist thinking. And Buddhism also, like Christianity and a number of other religions, has a kind of hell. They don't actually have one hell. They have there's a number of a graduated series of hells from the top to the bottom. And one of the interesting things is that nobody stays in hell forever. You know, in the West, the teaching has always been, you know, when you die, you go to heaven or you go to hell, and that's it for eternity. In the Buddhist world, you know, when you go to hell, you can go to some of the lower hells, but, you know, gradually you work your way out of hell. You basically burn off your bad karma, and you are transformed by your suffering, and eventually you're back in your human form, and then now you have another shot at becoming an enlightened being. So somebody like Angulimala, if you hear about him and you're a Buddhist, you think, oh brother, you know, he's going to be in the hell realms for a long, long time, right? What the story, the traditional story in the sutras is that Angulimala was lying in wait for another person to come down the road, and who should come down the road but the Buddha. And the Buddha is walking down the road with his begging bowl and a couple other monks. And Angulimala, is trailing him and preparing to kill him. When he comes up to the Buddha to kill him, he is surprised to see that the Buddha is not afraid or in any way disturbed. And Angulimala is like arrested, like in his plan, and he's so surprised and baffled by the Buddha that he begins to go through this very rapid crisis. And another way to put it is maybe in the presence of the Buddha, somebody so good, somebody so totally good, totally compassionate and kind, he's knocked off his feet. And he suddenly has this very powerful desire to change his life. And he stops to talk to the Buddha, and he tells the Buddha the whole story, right? And the Buddha says, you know, you have done terrible, terrible things in your life, you know, but your resolution to free yourself from your ignorance is your way, is the path, right? So Angulimala eventually shaves his head and becomes a monk, and he renounces, obviously, killing people and so on. What happened to him is that he very quickly has a great awakening experience. It's absolutely unquestionable. You know, the Buddha, when people hear about Angulimala's enlightenment experience, the monks and nuns who hear about this figure it must be a lie, because this is somebody who has done such terrible things, right? This is a person who has killed multiple people, you know, and they expect that such a person should surely have to go through many lifetimes of suffering to expiate his terrible karma, see? And everybody's disbelieving, you know, that Angulimala could have actually had great awakening experience. And some of the senior monks and nuns go to the Buddha and they say, how is this possible that this man, this terrible human being, has manage to have a great awakening experience. And the Buddha basically says, yes, you know, I can attest to the fact that he has awakened completely and he's free. So this is like, you know, this is a very troubling, for some people, very troubling story in the stories that come down to us from early Buddhism. And so Angulimala is a character here, and what he says to the woman as she's writhing in labor is doesn't seem to be the truth. In all the time I have followed the saintly and sagely way, never once have I taken life. So, you know, when I was thinking about koans that I might talk about right now, you know, I just stumbled on this koan, and it seems to me to be like the perfect koan. Because, you know, I don't know if you have been following the events in the Middle East, but you can scarcely have avoided seeing them, I think. And they're truly terrible, right? I mean, it's really unbelievable. You have you know the preliminary situation where people from Hamas crossed the border into Israel and basically killed a bunch of people who were actually like peaceniks. They were actually people who were arguing. A lot of people were in this community that was committed to peaceful resolution of tensions between the two communities, and they killed more than 1,000 of these people and took, as you know, many people hostage. And you know, if you followed the news and you followed the interviews with family members and people in the community, you know, there's shock, and then understandably there's just like this terrific sense of injury and this terrific sense of anger. And all of this is completely understandable, right? I mean, it might be one thing to understand that somebody would be killed on a battlefield. A soldier makes a choice, right? You become a soldier, you make a decision, you're going to live by, you know, you're going to live with life and death contingencies. You can die at any moment, you know. That's your choice. But when people like this are really committed to, you know, a good path, and they suffer this fate, that there's bound to be sort of this, first of all, this sense of shock and injury, right? It's like this painful sense of shock, and the injustice of it is bound to feel terrible, right? And then there's you know, it's, anger is totally understandable, right? It's completely understandable. And then, you know, on the other side, you know, right now I think we're up to like 10,000 people being killed in this military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And I'm sure you follow the facts, you know, that many of these people are innocent children, right? And most people, as a matter of fact, don't support Hamas. So this is a situation where, you know, the carnage just keeps mounting up. And, you know, I have been following this quite, as you can tell, I've been following this very closely. And, you know, there are very few people in Israel right now who are willing to agree to this humanitarian ceasefire. And of course, you know, if we don't do something, you know, thousands of people are going to die. And that when you look down the road, all one can imagine is this cycle of hatred and anger and this desire on all sides for retaliation. It's like, you know, everybody, the communities on both sides have been done an injustice. That's not to say they haven't also, I'm not denying they haven't also done injustices, right? But the communities on both sides have been done an injustice. And when done an injustice, one feels, you know, hurt angry and entitled to some kind of compensation, right? Some kind of compensation. And of course, this is sort of the way the monks and nuns feel about Anguimala, right? That this is a man who deserves to pay, right? He deserves to pay. And the fact that he doesn't pay, you know, he doesn't spend 10,000 years in the deepest hells burning off his evil deeds, really troubles these people, right? So this is really kind of the world of the koan. And I think it's extremely useful right now for dealing with some of these negative emotions. You know, I mean, I myself have always had to struggle with like anger issues. You know, I grew up in like a family where there was a lot of physical violence, right? You know, and as a child, I learned how to be fearful. When I was growing up in my own home, I was often like afraid, and I also spent a lot of my time in rather violent environments. So, you know, when I was a child, I lived in Baltimore, and Baltimore, a neighborhood I grew up in, was sort of a working class community. At that time, it was mostly white. Now it's mostly black. And in the post-war years, you know, the kids fought all the time. It was that kind of scrappy sort of working class culture where physical violence was part of the deal, right? So when I went to school, you know, I was never really sure if I was going to be safe or not. So, you know, for much of my life, I have had to struggle with, you know, anger issues. And I've noticed over the years in my years of sitting, you know, that I tend to get angriest when I feel like I'm being victimized, right? So if I feel like I'm being bullied or pushed around, I very quickly go to, you know, DEFCON 5 or whatever. I very quickly go to a place of righteous injury, righteous anger, right? And you know, in my Zen practice, you know, when I started Zen practice, I very much wanted to be an enlightened person, and knew in some way that I wasn't an enlightened person. And I really tried not to be an angry person. But trying not to be an angry person doesn't really work very well. You need to acknowledge your anger, and you need to sit with your anger. And as long as you say, I shouldn't be angry, or bodhisattvas don't get angry, you really can't learn anything from being angry, right? You really can't learn anything. So, in my early stages of my Zen practice, I always tried to imagine myself as an enlightened person. I knew I wasn't, but you know, I tried to think of myself as a peaceful person, a gentle person, a kindly person, and like all human beings, I have those qualities. But what I didn't want to look at was my anger. And I remember once Sesshin, where I was working on a koan, and I went in to present the answer. I went into the Dokusan room to present the answer to Genki Roshi. And he rejected my answer, and I came back, and I was furious. I was so mad at Genki Roshi. I don't think I would have hit him, but I was so mad I felt like I wanted to hit him, right? And I was sitting there in the Zendo just like I was a flame of anger. And I was thinking to myself, you know, Zen is bullshit. This is a lie. That, you know, I felt like standing up in the Zendo and going, it's all a lie, you know. So I was just so mad. And, you know, it took me a few visits to the Dokusan room before I was willing to tell Genki Roshi that I was angry, because I wanted him to think well of me, right? I wanted him to think that I was, you know, a star pupil of Buddhism, right? And you know, finally I was able to, like, come clean with him, you know, and about my how angry I was. And you know, when I told him this, you know, I was almost like crying because I was so ashamed. I was so ashamed to be angry. And you know, so the you know, what I was instructed to do was to sit with my anger, right? And sitting with my anger was one of the best things I have ever done in my Zen practice. You know, it took the rest of the sesshin, basically, right? But you know, as I'm sitting with my anger, I began to see all of these events in my life. It's like things that I had totally pushed away or forgotten about. You know, going into deep mushin and then, you know, experiencing, you know, these, remembering these events, which had really, I hadn't thought about in, you know, 20 years. And how often I felt helpless and undefended and so on and so on. You know, and I could just go through story after story, which I had pushed out of my mind. But as I'm, you know, day after day, I'm sort of living with this anger. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me is one of my big quote-unquote enemies when I was growing up in Baltimore was a kid named Bobby Westbrook. And Bobby Westbrook probably beat me up once a week. He lived in the apartment complex up the hill that we were in, these brick apart multi-family apartments. It was a big development, post-war housing, and he lived in an apartment up the hill. And he was, you know, a bully, and he was somebody I was really afraid of, and we often wound up fighting. And I remembered when I was working with my anger, you know, I began to really, like, remember Bobby Westbrook. And all of these details, you know, sort of floated up in my head, you know. Bobby Westbrook had no father. His mother was like a working, single mother working. The father was out of the picture. And she worked all the time. And he was at home by himself. Like, you know, that's actually, in many states now, that's illegal. But he was like this little kid taking care of himself most of the time. He was very lonely. He had no, you know, I realize now he had no friends. And he would come down to my house, and I realized, you know, he would actually beg me to be his friend. And it occurred as I was sort of like reviewing all of this, as all of this was coming back, I realized how desperate he was for me to be his friend. And, you know, often our interactions would lead to a fight. And then he would come back and renew this, you know. He didn't know how to be a friend. And he probably suffered physical violence himself, right? And he, you know, he was trying to make contact with me, and I wanted to get away from him, but, you know, that was actually making him feel even worse about himself. So, you know, I could spend a lot of time talking about Bobby Westbrook, who was like the bane of my life when I was like 7 years old. But, you know, as this all came back to me, I realized what a, you know, it just hit me like a ton of bricks that this kid, I saw his face, and I could even see, or imagine I could see, like the desperation and the unhappiness in his face. And as a child, I wasn't equipped to see that. You know, I wasn't equipped to understand him. He was just this guy who would beat me up occasionally. But, you know, I began to understand Bobby Westbrook's desperation and unhappiness. And, you know, when you reach a point like that with a person, something inside you resonates, right? It's like you realize, you know, you could almost say it's like love, right? This loving kindness. You realize this is a suffering person just like me, right? And the cause of my suffering, you know, but also deeply, you know, Bobby Westbrook was in a hell realm, you know, and I suppose he put me in a hell realm too, but he put me in a hell realm because he was in a hell realm. And he was lonely in his hell realm. So, you know, I don't know whatever happened to him. I've Googled him, actually. You know, I wonder whatever happened to him. There's a very famous American philosopher named Robert Westbrook, but I don't think that's him. I don't think Bobby Westbrook became a famous philosopher, but I bet he's had a tough life, right? Because I was experiencing all of this only from my own standpoint, you know, my sense of injury and the injustice of this, you know, and so on, my response, and the sense of helplessness, right, that feeling of helplessness, you know, anger was the only response available to me as a little kid, fear and anger. And, you know, working with this the anger koan, you could say, many years ago back at the Seattle Zen Center, you know, I began to see not just the sources of my anger, but I began to see the sources of other people's treatment of me. And this was really liberating. You know, so much of my own issues with anger come from not having worked all this through, right? Not having broken through to this moment of, you know. I don't even think you could call it forgiveness. It's like this moment of connection, right? It's a moment of connection. I think that the world community right now, as this is unfolding, you know, if you think about it, you know, if you think about what's the future going to look like, right? Obviously, Hamas can't solve these problems, right? And actually, invading military force is not going to solve the problem either. You know, I heard on the radio this man. He was NPR. He is a Palestinian living in Israel, and he is involved in a organization that tries to build bridges between the Palestinians and the Israelis, right? During this terrible catastrophe, he has been taking care of a number of Palestinians who aren't safe in Israel right now. If you're a Palestinian on the street, you could be the target of violence, right? And this kind of thing happened here in the United States after 9/11. You may recall that some Sikhs were killed or beaten up. You know, they're not Arabs, but most Americans don't know that Sikhs are not Arabs. They wear turbans, so they were the targets of violence, right? So he's using his facility to shelter Palestinians who are targets of violence. But he's also using some of the facility to shelter people who were in some of these communities that were attacked by Hamas. And as I listened to him, you know, I was thinking that this is the only way forward for these people, right? That this person has reached a place where he's able to work through. He's a Palestinian. He's been mistreated, but somehow he's been able to work through his anger and see on the other side of his anger the suffering of the people around him. And, you know, it may take a million years, but this is the future of the Middle East, right? If we could just go spinning around for another 1,000 years in a kind of hell realm. But people who are able to get past their own sense of injury and experience the suffering of actually the person who has injured you, you know, this is actually the only way out of this problem, right? And it doesn't matter if we're talking about the Middle East or we're talking about anywhere else in the world, right? I mean, this is the path, right? And nothing good can happen unless there are some people who are able to find this place in themselves where they cross that threshold and they move beyond their anger and experience the suffering of their victimizers, right? Because, you know, if you think about it, all of us are victimizers, as a matter of fact, right? All of us, you know. And you can say, well, I haven't killed anybody, but, you know, when I think back on it now, I've definitely been a bad person. I've treated people badly. You know, I've been a bully, as a matter of fact. I was bullied, and, you know, I've been a bully. You know, I realized that. That was something else I realized when I was working on this. You know, I've been unfair to people. I've been a bully. I've pushed people around. I've caused a lot of suffering, right? And I don't think there's anybody in the world, except maybe the Dalai Lama, who would not be able to say that in all honesty. And, you know, even the Dalai Lama has made some terrible mistakes, believe it or not, you know. I mean, I revere the Dalai Lama, but early in the period during the invasion of Tibet, you know, he made some decisions where lots of people got killed. Yes, lots of Tibetans got killed because he did his best. But, you know, basically he made decisions where people lost their lives. And I'm sure there are people who are angry at the Dalai Lama. So, you know, the Dalai Lama often says, you know, that anger is the most destructive emotion. And I would like to disagree with that, you know. I definitely think we should never allow our anger to remain anger, but I also think that, you know, anger is a great teacher, right? When we feel angry, we're encountering the door to a deeper relationship with other people, and it's actually in some ways the beginning of a more genuine relationship with other people. You know, it's easy to like people who treat you well, right? That's not a challenge, right? That's easy to do. And we don't really learn much from interacting with people who like us, as a matter of fact. You know, it's when we encounter somebody who hurts us, especially if we feel it's an undeserved injury, right? That we really have the chance to get outside of ourselves. I think that Angulimala is like a model for all of us. You know, I would say that we have all done things to injure others. And you know, we may even feel that, you know, we may even feel that what we've done is, you know, bad enough so that we will never be able to work our way through all of these layers of shame and regret and so on and so on. But, you know, what I was so surprised to find when I was working on this koan with Genki Roshi was that, you know, this anger that I thought was so deep and so, you know, impossible to deal with, you know, very quickly transformed into this experience of love. And I come away with that, you know, thinking that, you know, the anger and love, the ability to get beyond our limitations and experience others in a new way are really intimately and closely closely bound together, you know. And you know, I think that if people in the Middle East, you know, I think they have a chance, right? They have a chance to do something really profound. And I think sooner or later people have to do it, right? You know, that person who is welcoming into his facility, you know, the victimizers and the victims alike, you know, is really pointing us to, you know, the way for us as individuals and the way for us as a society. After Angwamala had left the householder's life and become a monk, so this is after he's met the Buddha and he's been sort of rocked back on his heels by the Buddha's kindness. You know, he's a killer and he's met this man who is like the embodiment of compassion. And it's so deeply moving. All I can think is that he himself must expect that his journey is going to be a really long and difficult one, you know. And so he's now a monk, and like all monks and nuns, he goes out begging for his food, right? He goes out with his begging bowl. And he came to the home of a wealthy man whose wife was having a difficult delivery. And the man said, "As a disciple of the Buddha, you must be very wise. Is there not something you can do to spare my life this difficult delivery?" And, you know, I think of Angwamala, you know, being asked this question and just thinking, I'm the last one who could bring anything good into the world, right? I'm the last person who could bring anything good into the world. I've murdered people, right? You know, I have no idea. I have no idea how to bring into the world to bring into this world something good or something better. I have no idea. And so he says, you know, I've only recently entered the way and do not yet know how to do this. I will go ask the Buddha and then return and tell you. And so he returned and explained the matter to the Buddha, who told him this. He says, "Go quickly and say, in all the time I have followed the saintly and sagely way, I have never taken life." So you know, I think one way to understand this is that, you know, no matter how no matter what mistakes we make in life, no matter how bad things get, you know, right behind everybody's hatred, there's this awakened mind. You know, right behind everybody's hatred, right beneath that, there's this awakened mind. And, you know, actually, for somebody like Angwamala, I see this as a koan about somebody who believes he can never change, or that couldn't be possible for him. But, you know, I'd like to think that this is the event that that allows him to wake up. In all the time I have followed the saintly and sagey way, never once have I taken life. So it's like all of that, behind all of that terrible history, right, there's this Buddha nature. And it's always there, and it's always accessible to us if we're willing to, you know, work through our obstacles. Angulimala went back and he told the wealthy man. As soon as the wife heard this, she gave birth. So it's like something had changed, right? It's like now into the world something new can come. You know, so this is a koan about how something good could come into the world, even when, you know, and who's going to bring something good into the world? It's this murderer. So, you know, I think this is an expression of real confidence and enlightened mind to overcome any obstacle. And I really like Master Bao Qi's poem. A tree overgrown with weeds, a jade carved to perfection, a lonely and desolate spot, a view of elegance and charm. The young lad seeking out the source of the night fragrance sees nothing but the moon shining at the foot of the stairs. You know, we often think we're the source of our anger is something done to us, but I just wonder if the source of our anger is that we have lost confidence in our own enlightened, in the possibility of our own enlightened nature. You know, in other words, you know, when something is done to you, something is done to you that injures you or that is painful, difficult to overcome. You know, I think when we get angry, we've lost confidence in our ability to access that awakened Buddha mind. You know, and that's the real source of our anger. It's not so much what has happened to us or what has been done to us as our own, you know, doubts about our enlightened nature. You know, so every time we sit down on the cushion and we enter into Buddha nature, you know, we enter into that calm, centered mind, you know, I think it in the long run it's going to make us more generous people, no matter what happens to us, because we develop this unshakable faith in our own enlightened nature and our own and the enlightenment at the heart of ourselves. And you know, once we reach that place, you know, it becomes so easy to understand others and forgive them. So I think that's what this koan is really all about. So today, everybody came and practiced the Great Way. We're all returning to our Buddha nature for a few minutes or a few hours. And if we have confidence in that, I think we can overcome anything that happens. So please keep practicing.